I would say the most effective school-based intervention for ADHD is the check-in. Checking in at the beginning of the day, potentially middle of the day, and end of day to make sure that not only did the student complete their work, but they actually turned it in. Because most of the time, that's the issue. They did it, and then it just never made it into the hands of the teacher. Or they did it, but whoops, they did the evens and not the odds this time.
Are you raising your family while also feeling like you're still growing up yourself? Do you wonder if you are getting it right? Or do you ask, where's the roadmap to building a happy, healthy life? Welcome to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. She's a pediatrician and a mom, and she helps the whole family.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, a board-certified pediatrician, but I'm not your pediatrician. Feel free to use my podcast as helpful information, but in no way do I intend my podcast to replace the advice of your physician. Your physician knows you and is in the best position to provide medical advice. Welcome back to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. As a pediatrician, I know how hard it can be for parents to know when should they be concerned about their child's learning or attention. Is it just a phase or a sign that they might need extra support? Around this time of year, as report cards and teacher feedback starts rolling in, so many parents find themselves wondering, should I be worried about my child's attention span or learning? Should we talk to a mental health professional? Or am I just overthinking? Well, today we're unpacking those questions with Dr. Kelly Christian, a clinical psychologist and clinical director of the Schaefer Center. She helps parents, children, and teens understand what's typical, what's not, and when to trust that gut feeling that says something just isn't clicking. Welcome, Dr. Christian.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Christian, at this point in the school year, so many parents are starting to wonder, is their child just adjusting or is something deeper going on? What are some signs that a child's learning or attention struggles might be worth looking into?
Sure. So I think it starts with age, right? So if this is your kid's kindergarten year, you might need a longer runway to sort out that question. But if this is a recurring concern that you've had for your child for several years or even just the end of last year, it may be worth digging in deeper to find out if your concerns are persistent in the school day, not just things that you're seeing at home. So, for example, if you have a family who's worried about attention, right? So after school, your kiddo is resistant to sit down and do homework. They just want to play, run around. That's fully warranted, right? But if they are so inattentive, you can't get them to sit down and complete a task without a lot of one-on-one attention. And this is something that you've been doing all year long since August, and it's not getting in any better with routine or structure, then I think it's something worth investigating a bit more. And starting with, what's my kiddo like at school? Or is it just they're saving it for me at home, right?
And that's such a great thing to think about, because I hear parents say to me, well, what do I do when the school says everything's fine, but the parents are telling me their gut says something isn't right? And what do you say to those parents?
Great question. So when I get this question from parents, the first thing I do is I try to dive a little bit deeper into what their actual concerns are. And as a clinician, I'm trying to sort out if this is a pattern of concerns that started early on, so in preschool, pre-K, kindergarten, first, second grade, or if this is something brand new that just came to light. And then I want to balance those concerns with what has actually been done in the school day to help and support the child. So, for example, I might have a family where they are suddenly concerned at second grade. They've never had any concerns at all prior to this year. But the school has said, well, we're going to put them into Title I. Don't worry. Right. And Title I is a fantastic program that our schools use to give kids extra time and support in an area like reading. And so with those families, I'm letting them know, like, OK, here's how this works. And I'll help them understand that with Title I, they usually should be getting daily 20 minutes additional instruction with some progress monitoring, and you should find if your child is responding. And if they're responding, fantastic. If they're not responding, then that's when I say, okay, circle back. We'll talk more about this gut feeling you have, and then talk through what those next steps might be.
Can you explain a little bit more detail? What is Title I for
Sure.
those that maybe have never heard it before?
Yeah. So in a public school, Title I is meant to provide additional support to students. Typically, it's the bottom 25%.
Okay.
So in the class, they'll screen all the children and determine, okay, these are the kiddos who are struggling a little bit. Let's give them some additional support and help and see if they respond. It's great in that we're, you know, trying to work from a preventative point of view, helping students right away, giving them additional support. And that's the hope with that.
And I really appreciate you explaining that, because I know often parents get nervous when we give a diagnosis, or we say that their child is having learning difficulties, or we tell them, oh, now they're going to be in a program, or they meet the criteria for Title I. Those words can sound pretty scary.
They can, yes. And I think for parents, a lot of times I'm helping them understand, like, you can ask the school what they're actually doing. A lot of families, when I ask them, okay, what intervention are they getting during the day, they have no idea. And it's not to say, like, they should know. I mean, it'd be nice if schools provided that information right up front, but it just might not be clear to them for some reason. And so confirming with the school what the child's actually getting, how many minutes, with who, if they're certified, not certified, all of that's valuable information.
That is great advice. And how does that differ from an IEP? Would you please explain what an
Sure.
IEP is and the differences between a child who is in a Title I learning program and those that have an IEP?
Sure. So a Title I learning program, again, is meant to catch those kids early, provide intervention quickly, to prevent concerns from sort of snowballing and getting worse. An IEP is quite different. There's a whole process before you're determined if you're eligible or not eligible for an IEP. IEP stands for Individual Education Plan. So the idea is this is your child's individual plan to help them access the curriculum. And the point of an IEP is to give both structured, systematic instruction and environmental accommodations so that that child has a level playing field so they can access curriculum, learn, and their pace of their output is not penalized if they're slower in getting things down. Instead, they're able to show what they know and are able to learn for mastery. That's the hope of an IEP. But to get an IEP, there's a whole process behind it. You have to do a multi-factored evaluation through the school district that involves, you heard the big phrase, multi-factored. That means it involves lots of people. So classroom teachers, speech-language pathologists, occupational therapists, school psychologists, they're all working together as a team. They gather lots of different data. It could be behavior observations in the classroom, data around cognitive functioning, like how well the child reasons and how well they process information, academic data, and again, like speech language, fine motor skills, that kind of thing. They pull all of that together as a team. The parents are part of that team, and then they discuss whether or not that child requires specially designed instruction. And if they do, and the team decides yes, that's when they move forward with an IEP for the student. If they don't qualify, let's say, actually, they're doing quite better than we thought they would. They might just need additional, like, tier two services. So tier two services mean it's additional support and intervention, but not at an IEP level, but more than a Title I level. And they're kind of like in this gray area. And then the idea is with that, like, let's continue to progress monitor and then make sure that the student is progressing. And if they are, fantastic. If they're not, we'll reopen the IEP conversation.
If you liked today's episode so far and it hits close to home for you, please like and subscribe to the podcast. It just takes one click. And please share it with other parents. And if you have topics you'd like for me to discuss here on Growing Up with Dr. Sarah, reach out to us. Leave us a voice message. Instructions are in the description box below. Stick with me. We have more coming up on learning differences and school struggles. I know we really jumped from that gut feeling all the way to IEP. So let's fill in the middle. What's the best way for parents to document and communicate their concerns to the school once they've got a sense that something's going on with their child?
Yeah, great. So really, I tell families it's all about data. So if you're getting homework assignments turned back to you and they're saying like 1 out of 6, 1 out of 7 problems are right, keep those. Also keep any communications between you and the teacher that show your concerns have been voiced or teacher's concerns have been voiced back to you, so that you can show the sort of like through line of we started the year like this and we're still here 12 weeks later. I'm really concerned about my child's progress. So the data is incredibly helpful in making that decision to go from gut feeling to let's have an MFE in place. Yeah.
And what is an MFE?
Sure. So that's the multi-factor evaluation.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Yep.
Nice. It's a nice way to abbreviate it. Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah. Yeah. And in order to get one, you have to request it. And then the school still needs to determine, should we even do the multi-factor evaluation? So some families think, oh, well, I request it. They have to do it. Mm-hmm. Well, they don't have to, because if they don't have data and evidence that suggests they need to test for this child, meaning, okay, the child is not progressing, but we've been intervening, they don't have to do it. And that's because they serve so many kids right at one time. So it's just not something that they can do for every request that's given. So for parents who have that gut feeling, start collecting information, because that can be useful in determining like this next time period of like, okay, let's move ahead with an eval instead of let's wait and see another couple weeks.
And are there particular questions or phrases that help open up those productive conversations with teachers or school psychologists to get to that point where you need an MFE?
Yeah, great question. So one of the things that families often will ask, they'll say, oh, I asked the school if my kid has dyslexia. Mm. And I asked the school to evaluate for dyslexia. And unfortunately, a lot of schools don't recognize that term. They'll say, we don't test for that. And that's because they technically don't. They're testing for your eligibility for a specific learning disability. They're not testing for dyslexia. So if you use the phrase specific learning disability in your suspicion letter saying like, dear principal, I am concerned about Johnny and his reading and his progress, I suspect he has a specific learning disability, that starts the like ding, 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 let's look at this kiddo, let's consider whether or not we need an MFE. If you write, I suspect my child has dyslexia, you probably get this, Dr. Adams, a lot. They'll tell them, go to your pediatrician.
Yes.
That's a medical diagnosis. Which is unfortunate, because then families are then sort of like stuck waiting to connect with a provider, connect with like answers, because they've been told we don't do that here, which I mean is true. They're not in the business of diagnosing at all. Schools do not diagnose, but they are in the business of deciding and finding the children in their district who legally require special education. And so they use legal terms like disability and not clinical terms like disorder.
Well, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because let's talk about what the difference is between a learning disorder, a learning disability, or when someone says they have a learning difference.
Oh, yeah. Good question. So learning difference, I think, is like the broad term now that everyone's using to try. It's like a big umbrella, and it could mean lots of different things. So learning difference is a nice way to communicate very quickly that I have a bright student, and yet their academics are underdeveloped or not where we expect them to be. And so that's what makes the difference. That's the learning difference. Brights with unexpected underachievement. And that's a key part of the diagnostic picture. So like if we're looking for a diagnosis in the clinical manual, we often look for this unexpected underachievement. So learning difference captures that. Learning disorders, the clinical term that we use, requires that the student has to be bright with unexpected underachievement and then some specific areas of challenge. And so for dyslexia specifically, it's spelled out that you have to struggle with decoding, fluency, and spelling. Okay, so you may or may not struggle with reading comprehension. Your comprehension could be just fine. And that is because we have so many kids who are bright with dyslexia who can infer meaning, right? They get enough of the words down that they can kind of fill it in based off of experience, knowledge, vocabulary, that kind of thing. So in a clinical setting, we're using the term disorder. In a school setting, they're using the term disability, but again, it's really just reflected of the like legal terms that they need to use, but it's recognized just the same. So to have a disability of reading in a school system, you have to be bright and then have low foundational reading scores. And recently, because Ohio has passed the dyslexia law, more schools I'm noticing in their IEPs and MFEs are starting to use the term dyslexia, which is fantastic because now it's sort of bridging this gap between what parents are hearing at school and what parents are hearing from clinicians. And I just found so many parents that were frustrated, like, I don't understand. Why can't they just recognize the term dyslexia? And I'm like, I know that's not their job. Their job is to recognize your educational need and your educational rights to a free and appropriate education. So that's, they're staying in their lane. That's fine. But it is confusing to have so many different terms for the same thing.
And I appreciate you really spelling that out because learning difference, what I heard you say is their ability to perform is here, but they're performing actually here. So we're seeing a difference in what they can do and where they actually are. And so these resources are to help bridge that gap to get them to where they actually could be.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's important to remember that reading is something we invented as a society about 5,000 years ago. So we don't have like a reading center of the brain. We have this like carefully orchestrated coordination of like different systems in our brain all working together to help us read intuitively. But for about 20% of us, that system is disrupted or slower. And so they need systematic instruction to make that like neuronal connection in the brain more fluid so that they can then read with better fluency and spell with better understanding of like sound letter associations and decode well. So.
When parents hear words like neuropsychological evaluation or psychoeducational testing, what does that process really look like? Is that the same thing as you're saying the MFE?
Pretty much.
Or is that something totally different?
Yeah, pretty much. So school psychologists, clinical psychologists, and neuropsychologists. We all have very different jobs, but we have the same tools for assessment. The only difference is, again, training, right? So as a clinical psychologist, I'm trained in order to diagnose and determine the needs of children and give their, you know, scripted, you know, recommendations. Like, here's what we need for ADHD. Here's what we need for specific learning disorder. Sorry. And, you know, anxiety, depression, that kind of thing. A school psychologist is assessing mainly for school-specific recommendations, right? They're not doing anything clinical and they're recommending. Neuropsychologists are able to call themselves neuropsychologists because they had special training, a two-year postdoc, after their clinical psych training. And so they tend to work more in hospital settings or they're working with students, children who've experienced some sort of assault on the brain. So like a traumatic brain injury. They've experienced chemotherapy because of a cancer treatment. That kind of thing. Something that impacts the brain. And we're trying to now sort out like what parts of the brain are impacted by this event that occurred. Neuropsychs will still test for ADHD and learning disorders, but they do tend to take more complicated cases.
So there's so much that goes into it. But I'd like to move forward because I think that we want to find that hope and start talking about some practical steps. Because once that diagnosis or learning profile is identified, what are some of the most effective interventions and supports for children with ADHD, dyslexia, or other learning differences?
So with ADHD, we often talk about the three-pronged approach, right? So it's psychoeducation, like what is ADHD, and helping parents, hopefully the school is already aware, but helping parents for sure understand like what ADHD is, that it's not something that goes away overnight, and helping them know that this is a brain-based concern. Essentially, your frontal lobe is maturing at a much slower rate than other kids that same age. And so because of that, they are not necessarily looking forward to the future to inform their current behavior and decisions, right? So I can skip studying tonight because I'll figure it out tomorrow on the bus. And then, whoops, forgot to do it on the bus. And now they're taking a quiz and they're, you know, wigging it, right? So
I feel like you're talking about my oldest son. Sorry, yes. Gabe, if you're listening.
Yeah. So with ADHD, that psychoeducation piece is huge. It's also helpful for families to really understand that ADHD is kind of poorly named. It's not attention deficit. It's that these are kiddos that pay too much attention to what's around them, and that brain is often seeking novelty. That's why they're very distracted, right? They're very good at picking up little things that are going on around them and having their mind track that instead of listening to the instructions that the teacher just gave, right? So in that psychoed piece, that gives a lot of understanding so that parents can hopefully come to the parenting side of things with a little more warmth, empathy for their kid, and also, more importantly, for themselves. Yes. It's incredibly hard to parent a child with ADHD, especially as they get older and are seeking more independence, and you're trying to provide them that, and yet at the same time, it's a little hard to do for some children. The second piece, so I talked about a three-pronged approach, is often medication. So that's a conversation that families can have with their pediatrician or a child psychiatrist, especially if it's a little more complicated. And really, that conversation is to help families decide, like, okay, would medication help stimulate that frontal lobe enough so that they are now able to attend better, reduce their impulse to disrupt themselves and others, that kind of thing. The third piece is behavioral support. So that could be in the classroom setting. So we often talk about a 504 plan, which is environmental accommodations, in the school setting, where the environmental accommodations are giving them access to the curriculum through like preferential seating, frequent check-ins with a teacher, direct instruction. So instead of saying like, Tommy, what are you supposed to be doing right now? Look yeah. around you. It's Tommy, open your workbook to page 12.
Mm-hmm.
Great job, Tommy. Now we're ready to go. It's that kind of like positive, direct instruction and concise. So those three things when pulled together are often quite helpful for students. I would say the most effective school-based intervention for ADHD is the check-in. Checking in at the beginning of the day, potentially middle of the day, and end of day to make sure that not only did the student complete their work, but they actually turned it in. Because most of the time, that's the issue. They did it, and then it just never made it into the hands of the teacher. Or they did it, but whoops, they did the evens and not the odds this time. Let's correct it so that you can then get credit. So the check-ins are huge in supporting that student, and especially over time, they begin to learn a routine to check themselves. And then they're able to have a little more freedom as they advance through school because the folks around them can start to see, like, you're having success, they're experiencing success. Now let's try this more on your plate. less on the person checking in with you's plate and see how you do. Yeah.
How can this check-in include a collaborative relationship with their child's school team after testing and medication has been prescribed if it's determined it's needed?
Yeah, so this is a great way to collaborate, right? So with a 504 plan, you can then ask for these check-ins to occur. So parents then know that there's some sort of assurance during the day that your kiddo's not just like out in the wind trying to make it through the day. So parents will often see at the end of the day, like a planner has been completed and signed off by, you know, Mrs. Jones in study hall. These are definitely like for slightly older students. For younger students, it's a lot easier because elementary school teachers are already on top of your kid, you know, 24/7. And so those quick little emails between you and that teacher are easy to access and collaborate with each other. In the middle school and high school, it's tougher. And that's where setting it up for success ahead of time by establishing who and when we'll check in are valuable. That can often take your kiddo from, you know, kind of semi-performing a little bit better now that they're on medication to really doing quite well in school. Because now it's also taking the parent out of the equation, right? A lot of parents want to know, where is your homework? What homework do you have? And when their student says, I have nothing, the parent says, that can't be possible. You have homework every day. And they're like, no, I have nothing. And then you open the planner. Oh, no, you have this. Now the parent can help make sure that the child's actually doing what they're supposed to be doing because somebody wrote it down and checked that it was accurate. And then usually the kid's like, oh, I forgot. Right. So then they can sit down and do it and get it done. But if it's, you know, clunky in the beginning, like you do have to kind of work out the kinks a little bit, like who's the person checking in? Because sometimes here's the interesting thing I'll find a lot of times these kiddos with ADHD find their best favorite teacher, or the teachers with ADHD, because they're super energetic and excited and willing to help and do everything for everyone. And they're not always the best ones at writing things down and checking. So it could be a little bit clunky until you find the right person to check in with your student. But it's well worth it for sure. And it does really amplify that collaboration between school and home because now there's just better communication and you're not relying on your own child to figure it out for you, which leads to a lot of frustration between parents and their child, right? Like, how can you not just know? Like, how do you not know what your math homework is, right? Like those like arguments are heartbreaking.
They really are. And it also helps with the relationship between the family and the school, because a lot of times by doing this check-in and collaborating, the parents know what the school is doing. They know what's, you know, it fills in the gaps, because often I'll see in my practice, they'll say, well, I don't really know what the school is doing, or I'm not even sure if they're following the 504 plan. And I believe that they are, but if there is a check-in, and thank you for naming that it can be clunky, because you got to work through that, and that's okay, right?
Yes.
It's okay. You got to get through that. And because in the end, having those check-ins and that collaboration and that communication, it helped, ultimately, we're just trying to help the child learn.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's important for families to remember too. Like, teachers got into this work not because they wanted summers off. They did it because they really care. And they want to do a great job with your child. And so, you know, coming from that standpoint of like openness to finding out like what helps in their classroom, what have they seen in the past work well, and then opening that line of communication is huge. Yeah.
I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention at least one or two points about what is effective in regards to interventions with dyslexia.
Sure. Yeah. So with dyslexia, we have a really well understood model of care. So it's typically some sort of multisensory systematic instruction that's language based. You've probably heard of Orton-Gillingham as a curriculum. That's like the big mother program that covers all these key pieces of like, how do we learn to read? What's the sequence of learning to read? and then outlining it systematically so that kids learn the rules and system for reading and also writing and spelling. So Ort and Gillingham sort of this like mother program, and from that comes other programs. So like Wilson's really popular in Northeast Ohio, because we just have a lot of folks that are certified in it and have learned it. We also have like Barton system or alphabet, like phonics, like some sort of phonics program. Hegarty is another phonics program that a lot of people use around here. And these things are available. You just have to find out what your district's using, who's certified to provide those interventions. So if you want an Ort and Gillingham provider, but your school says, oh, sorry, we have a Wilson certified instructor, that's not a bad thing. That's fine, because it's sort of like going to the dentist and the dentist says, what toothpaste are you using? And if you say Crest, but the dentist is like, no, Colgate, you know that that's like not really a big difference. We need the active ingredient of fluoride. And so all of these systems have the active ingredient of multisensory, systematic, sequential instruction in how we learn to read. But I think for families who are a little concerned to get certified in Ort and Gillingham, it's sort of like a higher level of instruction and supervision before you become certified in that. While Wilson sometimes is a little less effective because they have versions of trainings where you can have Wilson exposure in a weekend or over the course of a week or two versus 6 months, right, or a year. And so that makes the difference. Like, is the tutor actually using it with fidelity? But it's a good program on its own.
Well, and I appreciate you sharing all of that. It is complicating. And I want to share with those that are listening that these are conversations to bring up with your school, with your teacher, with the guidance counselors, and with your primary care provider so that they can guide you and take that gut feeling that you're having. Finally, what message do you want parents to take away if they're feeling unsure, overwhelmed about what they're seeing in their child right now?
Well, there's really lots of people to help, right? So you're not alone. You could always reach out to neighbors and friends and kind of question, like, did you have issues with Johnny learning to read with Mrs. So-and-so? You can get some feedback first. That can go a long way. But at the school, there's oodles of people to help, primarily the classroom teacher who sees your child. But if that's not enough to help you feel better or give you information on next steps, that's where you could talk to folks like a clinical psychologist who can give you their own perspective, or a primary care physician who can then guide the family on whether or not this is really a concern or not a concern. So reaching out to the school, reaching out to neighbors and friends, reaching out to clinicians in the community, we're all available to help answer questions and give perspective too. I do find like a lot of families that are really concerned about the possibility of something, you know, being on the table, it might be because of their own difficulties learning in school. And so they question, okay, ooh, is this coming from me or not? So it can be somewhat of a shameful conversation. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to make it sound like, oh, it's easy, just talk to people. But I think it's important for families to know that the number one thing I hear from families all the time is, I wish I didn't wait so long. I wish I got on this sooner. So starting with, you know, neighbor, primary care, or a phone call with a clinical psychologist can be all very helpful. And that's why the Schaefer Center exists, right? Like, we're here to take calls from families, help them, guide them in like what their next steps should be. It could start with a screening level, right? Like, let's just take a look at your reading. And then that way I can give you feedback from an outside perspective on whether or not this is a concern worth investigating. And then give them information on next steps. Or we can just talk them through, like, actually, everything sounds great. Circle back if needed, which happens all the time, especially for our real little kids, like pre-K and kindergarten. So we're just serving as a resource to families in the area.
Thank you so much, Dr. Christian, for sharing this information. I know I appreciated it, and I know those that are listening have really learned a lot, that their gut feeling is important and that they're not alone. Understanding what's going on with your children helps us see their strengths, find the right supports, and sets them up to learn in ways that works best for them. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Christian's work or explore resources on learning and attention differences, we'll include the information in the show notes. And if this episode resonates with you, please take a moment to share it with another parent or caregiver who might need to hear that they're not alone. I'm Dr. Adams. Thank you for listening, and let's grow up together.
Produced by Autovita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.